Time now for hour number two of this weekend's two-hour installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here is the host of the program, Carol Marks, in conversation with Leslie Brown Halper, Ph.D. She's a research associate at Corpus Christi College and a Tibet scholar. She's going to discuss with Carol her new book titled Tibet, An Unfinished Story, published by Oxford University Press.
Let's talk first about your interest in a better future for Tibet. And wasn't that sparked when you got to visit it in 1997 and you were actually a guest of the Chinese government in the capital, Lhasa? So what are some of the horrific things you saw that made you realize the Chinese had systematically proceeded to destroy their culture and that they were trying to unseat the Dalai Lama?
Yes, we were indeed guests on our first visit in 1997 of the Chinese, and we managed to get them to agree to let us go up to Lhasa for a week. We had three minders. We were put into a small hotel just outside of the main Barkhor Square. In those days, the Westerners stayed there and were told that we were not allowed to leave the hotel. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, we got up, and we thankfully were on the main floor, and we snuck out of our window, and we managed to get down to the Jokon Temple, and we were just really shocked. The Chinese in those days had these hydraulic cameras that came up in the night to sort of look at what was happening. You saw them go down in the morning because we had stayed there until the miners managed to find us. And what we found was, yes, we do call it a deconstruction of the Tibetan culture. These monasteries are no longer places of worship. They're on sort of a Disneyland tour. You get a ticket to see a monastery or the Jokon Temple by the Barkhor Square. And they've just hollowed out the culture in a way that the Chinese are very good at with their propaganda and their revisionist history of Tibet. So we were struck. We were so shocked, I think, because you don't hear that much about what's going on there. And then we came back and began to write editorials about it. We were no longer invited to be guests of the Chinese, although we managed to get in a few times in the years 2000 afterwards. So we were very surprised and decided that we would dedicate the next 15 years to writing about this.
And you know, you pointed out something that I had never, ever thought of, and I think it's so important. And that was one of the reasons that motivated the Chinese, whatever his name, maybe I want to not pronounce it because he because he was such a tyrant, but what motivated him to invade Tibet in 1950 really had something to do with the vast mineral resources that Tibet has right under the ground there, and I never thought about it or knew that they were there.
Yeah, this is a huge, vast Tibetan plateau, and it wasn't just minerals, but that's what Mao was looking for. He had made that clear to a young Dalai Lama, who you have to think was 15 years old in 1950. Really, he was in a tough position. He made that clear. He said, you know what, you've got the land, and I've got the people. And they wanted to come in and take those resources and, you know, transfer Han populations into Tibet. In 1950, Tibet was basically 100% Tibetan. Now it's probably 50% Tibetan. So, yes, they were mining, looking for the wealth, the land. They've taken the lumber. And, of course, the most important thing is the water. They're damming up those rivers that go into India, into other countries in South Asia. China needs water. And the Himalayas, the draining from the Himalayas, these glaciers that are melting, the Chinese are using that for their own purposes.
Terrible. So, and what about the gold and the oil? Are they doing? Are they taking those too?
Yes, I understand that they're drilling as well. And the thing is that there's no monitors in the international community. You know, if you're drilling or you're damming or if you're cutting down trees, we have standards. Well, you're not going to do this to the land, or there's nobody monitoring this. So we don't hear about it, and nobody's up there watching what the Chinese are doing except for the Tibetans who see it.
At the time that the Chinese invaded Tibet in 1950, the Tibetans, of course, looked to the U.S., Britain, and India for aid, and none of these countries, including us, helped them. Why didn't we and the other countries do it? What were their concerns about helping them?
when this is, it's a very tragic story. When the Chinese invaded, and a small, insular, very naive government in Lhasa looked, as you said, to Britain, the United States, and India, they actually encountered what I would call is a perfect storm. On one side, they found this new aggressive Beijing that was intent on absorbing the Buddhist kingdom. On the other, there was Prime Minister Nehru, who believed India's security and interests required that he cooperate with Beijing. He shared a 2,000-mile border. And then, of course, there was Britain, whose post-war financial straits severely limited any ongoing role. And then, of course, the United States, who was constrained at home with domestic issues, and abroad they were preoccupied with other priorities. So the United States could not, it was a very difficult time for the United States, who was probably the one country to give any overt aid. They were also constrained by the domestic politics at the time, and that was the China lobby, who believed, like the communists, that's the nationalists, and Chiang Kai-shek, who believed that Tibet was part of China. And the United States at the time believed that the nationalists would help to thwart the communist rise in China.
And yet the United States did, under Presidents Truman and later Eisenhower, have a covert CIA program to try to support the Dalai Lama and resist the occupation. That must have been a tough thing to do, and wasn't it at all successful?
That was a great moment, I would say. One of the CIA officials that I interviewed said it was one of the most romantic covert operations they ever did. It began in its full term in the summer of 1956 under Eisenhower. And they trained hundreds and or upwards of 1,000 men or more at the end in places like Saipan and the Mariana Islands, then to Camp Hale in Colorado, and then finally back into Nepal. And these Tibetan resistance fighters were trained in what we would call black arts, covert ops. And they learned how to decode and understand messages, airdrops, so that the United States would understand what the Chinese were doing at the time. So, you know, was it successful? Indeed, the U.S. was able to harass the Chinese, but the Tibetans at the end did not get their independence, and that's what most of them had wanted at the time. So while it did help the Tibetans to gain their public sort of recognition, it was not recognition in terms of independence.
Now, fast forwarding to 1959, that was when they had a big uprising in Tibet of the people, and then the Dalai Lama felt he had no other choice but to flee to India, where he denounced the People's Republic, and he really established a Tibetan government in exile. So you point out something very, very interesting in the book when you say that the Chinese leader Mao, having heard that the spiritual and temporal leader of Tibet, the Dalai Lama, had escaped, said, "In that case, we have lost the battle." I think that's so interesting.
Well, they really wanted to use the Dalai Lama. Again, as I pointed out, he was young, and they felt that Mao felt and Zhou Enlai felt that they could manipulate this young boy to sort of support their cause of communism and to be the leader in Tibet, to bring the people along to be good little communists. But of course, it didn't happen when the Dalai Lama was there in Tibet. There's a strong nationalist sense in Tibet, as there is today. They had their own language, their culture, or literature. And so, of course, Mao realized that now the Dalai Lama would come out. And then, of course, what he did, he told the world what was going on there. And this made it more difficult for the Chinese after 1959.
Now, in 2010, as a news correspondent with Talk Radio News Service, I had one of the most extraordinary, moving experiences of my life, meeting and being blessed by His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama in Upper Dharamsala, India, which is the present seat of the Tibet's government in exile has. And I'm always asked what it was like to stand next to the Dalai Lama and talk to him. And what impressed me the most was how charismatic and caring he was when he spoke to me. He just radiated compassion for all forms of life. And he had a great sense of humor, too.
I couldn't agree with you more. And we were very fortunate 2 months ago to meet the Dalai Lama in Washington, D.C. one-on-one, and I could not agree with you more about this charisma. You know, he looks right at you. He's speaking to you, and you definitely feel the sense that there's a greater power behind this man, and it's a lovely feeling. And I think that it's hard to explain because when people talk about spirituality, I think it's all encompassed in this figure, the Dalai Lama. And, of course, it's going to be very difficult when he passes away. The Tibetan people are going to lose a great leader, and it will be difficult to get another human being in that place that has so much and has so much to give.
But, you know, I think that Tibet is a place where people see Buddhism and their spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, as so important that it's not only the religion, but it's also the essence of their identity. So they will find a Dalai Lama that they can support. It will continue. Now, I wanted to tell you also about what the Dalai Lama had to say to me about, and probably he said some of this to you too, about what he was, seeking. Not an independent Tibet, but, you know, meaningful autonomy in local provinces and greater freedom of religion. But what he talked to me about in particular, Leslie, was the media in America. And he is so right that we are not writing enough on a regular basis about what's going on in Tibet, the day-to-day trials and tribulations the Tibetans experience living there, as you said, being almost a minority with the Han Chinese living there. And instead, mostly what we're hearing out of Tibet is the stories of various types of protests.
You're correct, and I think that Tibet has sort of slid down the ladder, and I think it should be in a more important issue because it deals with basic human rights. And our government, starting from Roosevelt forward, and of course even before that, it's the right of self-determination of people. These people should not be suppressed. They can't practice their religion. They can't have a picture of the Dalai Lama, or they're in prison. So I think that, yes, it should be elevated, and I think it's more in the news, but yes, we see, unfortunately, that it isn't. It's one of the reasons that we decided to write the book, because we feel very strongly about this issue and about what's happened to the Tibetan people, and we hope others will read the book and write about it as well.
That's Leslie Brown Halper in conversation with Carol Marx. The book is titled Tibet, An Unfinished Story, published by Oxford University Press. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host, Carol Marx, in conversation now with Dr. Martin Blaser. He's director of the Human Microbiome Program at New York University and is the author of Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues, published by Henry Holt & Company.
When it comes to the human microbiome, you've written that every human being is host to around a trillion bacterial cells, outnumbering their human cells 10 to 1. And in fact, 90% of all the cells in the body and outside of our body aren't human at all. So they're microorganisms. So what is a microorganism? Why do the scientists call the bacteria in our bodies the microbiome?
So microorganisms are forms of life that are too small to be seen by the naked eye. They can usually be seen under the microscope, and they include things like bacteria and fungi, very small cell organisms. And as you say, most of the cells in the human body are in fact microbes. In fact, they outnumber us 10 to 1, as you've said. It's actually 100 trillion, not 1 trillion, but 100 trillion
wow.
cells are microbes. And these are ancestral. we got a lot of them from our moms, and they got them from their moms, and so on and so forth. It goes all the way back in time.
Now, here's something that really floored me, the size of our microbiome. So what is it? How big is it?
Well, again, the bacterial cells are much smaller than our human cells, so it's been estimated it weighs about 3 or 4 pounds, about the size of our brain, and we think of it as another organ of the body because it's doing a lot of work for us. The microbiome helps train our immune system. It helps us digest food. It makes vitamins for us. It helps defend us against invaders.
So it does so many helpful things. Now, you have just, said that we get our microorganisms from our mother. And why, then, are the first years in children's lives so important when it came to keeping ourselves in our body living together peacefully?
Right. Well, I'm going to answer your question by saying, first, I'm a member of the AARP, and I'm happy to be talking to members of AARP because they have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And this book is especially important about them because during the early years of life, that's when babies are developing, it's when children are developing, and we want them to develop in good, healthy ways. And it turns out that the microbes that we get early in life are aiding in that development. And my whole concern, and that's why I called it missing microbes, is that something has gone askew, and our kids aren't getting all the right microbes that they used to get, or they're getting them and they're losing them because of things like very common treatment with antibiotics.
You know, things like earaches.
Well, right. So kids very commonly have ear infections, and doctors are giving children antibiotics for these ear infections. But we know that about 80% of the ear infections are due to viruses, and antibiotics don't even work. But both the doctors and the patients think that the antibiotics don't have any biological cost. So they're prescribing antibiotics tremendously. The average child in the United States is probably getting 4 courses of antibiotics in the first 2-3 years of life. That's across every child in the U.S. Some kids are even getting more. By the age of 10, the average child in the U.S. has gotten 10 courses of antibiotics. By the time they're 20, they've gotten 17 courses of antibiotics. Now, in contrast, in Sweden, they're using 40% of the antibiotics we're using. That means that 60% of the antibiotics we're using are unnecessary. And this is happening at childhood, young adulthood, at older adulthood. The Swedes, who are just as healthy as we are, and maybe even healthier, are using much less antibiotics.
And I guess they're doing, they've really gone on a campaign in France to lower the use of antibiotics, something that we are sorely not doing.
Yeah, well, we're starting there. We're starting there, but we have a long way to go. And again, the reason the French are doing this is that they use a tremendous amount of antibiotics too. And if antibiotics were free, then there'd be no problem. But we and others are finding that there are more and more costs to antibiotics, which is why I wrote Microbes, to inform the general public about this, that they're not free, and that my concern is that many of the diseases that are starting in childhood, like obesity and juvenile diabetes and allergies and food allergies, these are all being fueled by the changes in our microbiome, our children's microbiome, driven by all this antibiotic use.
Now, being a scientist, how do we know we're losing some of these healthy microbes? I mean, has there been any research done, and why is diversity in our bacteria so important?
Well, we know that forests and grasslands that are diverse are very hardy. They can withstand all kinds of changes in the environment. They can withstand invaders of different kinds of species. But when you lose diversity, you lose that kind of resilience. And so that's one of my concerns, is that we'll lose resilience. But there have been scientific studies now that have looked at the diversity in the intestinal tract of the microbes that are present, and we have much less diversity than people in developing countries. And it's been estimated that we've lost 30 to 40% of our diversity already. It's kind of been silent under the radar screen. but we're concerned that this is will risk for diseases that infect that sometimes elderly people get, such as C. diff infections involving their intestines.
And there's another really frightening superbug out there called MRSA, and you can pronounce it for me, but why is this bacteria so scary, and what can we do to protect ourselves against it?
Well, this bacteria, MRSA, or methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, is an antibiotic-resistant bacteria. It arose in hospitals where they use a lot of antibiotics, and it can cause very, very serious infections. And what's important is that in recent years, it's not just in people who are in hospitals. It's spread out into the community. So the question is, why is this organism spreading? And my idea is that it's because we've lost some of our natural barriers against these bacteria. The loss of diversity, in fact, may be playing a role.
Now, what's so helpful about your book, Dr. Blaser, is the fact that not only do you spell out the problems we're having maintaining the number of good bacteria we need, but you also offer some common sense solutions. And so can you tell us about some of the constructive things that we need to implement in our country?
Well, the first thing is that, as I said, people who have mild illnesses should not be taking antibiotics. They should not. Please give me an antibiotic because they're not without cost. And this is people at really all different ages. Another thing for parents, if the doctor says your child doesn't need an antibiotic, they shouldn't feel deprived. They should insist we want an antibiotic. Another point that I want to bring up is that the rate of cesarean sections has just gone up dramatically in years. It used to be 10% of all births were by C-section. Most recently, it was a third of all babies born in the United States were by C-section. Again, everybody's thinking that C-sections are free biologically, but we have evidence that that transfer of microbes to moms from moms to babies is altered when there are C-sections. So these are some issues. Another issue is the hand sanitizers that everybody seems to be using. We're using it by the tens of millions of applications every day. There isn't really any evidence that this is any good for us, and my concern is that it's removing the good bacteria, not just the bad bacteria. And in the long run, I don't know whether we're doing more good or harm. When it's flu season, these hand sanitizers are important. When people are in hospitals, they're important. But for the other 95% of the times, they may be doing more harm than good.
That's Dr. Martin Blaser in conversation with Carol Marks. The book is titled Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues, published by Henry Holt & Company. You're listening to A Touch of Gray.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We're joined the rest of the way here this big second hour of our two-hour get-together by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, who just moments from now will be talking with Scott Stossel, the editor of Atlantic Magazine, and he has a memoir called My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, published by Random House Knopf, and that's coming up in a moment. But first, Richard, you are a sportsman extraordinaire, and there's a few things happening in the world of sports. Matter of fact, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the World Cup, but before we do, because we don't have a lot of time in this segment, the ongoing basketball finals are very interesting this year, and full disclosure, we're having this conversation in the middle of the week, so we don't really know how it's going to play out by the weekend when the show runs. But you know what I find, and I'd like your take on it, one of the really cool things about both the Spurs and the Heat is that they really are the quintessential teams. You know, the cliche, there's no I in sports. These two teams both operate with selfless players for the most part. As a sports expert, would you agree?
Oh, I'd have to say so. I mean, Phil Jackson has written about that. He says that you have to trust your teammates. All the teammates have to trust each other, which is why The other night, LeBron James had a shot. He passed it up, gave it to his teammate Chris Bosh, who missed it in the previous series. And everybody was like, well, why did he do that? And that's the essence of being a team player. You got a tough shot, the guy's wide open, let him shoot. Trust him.
And you'd think that this would be obvious, and yet it isn't. And some guys really just care about their own numbers, don't they?
Well, and you also have criticism. Hey, he's LeBron James. He's the best player on the court. He should take the shot. And it's not that simple.
Have you noticed that somehow into the jargon of sports talk, LeBron James is now increasingly being referred to, I don't know how this started, as the best basketball player in the world? Have you heard, and people just say it like it's a given. Well, you know, we're on the same team with the best basketball player in the world. Or here, you know, so-and-so is now guarding the best basketball player in the world. When did that start? Was that a reaction to Kevin Durant getting MVP?
No, I don't think so. I think it's pretty universally acknowledged that he is the best player in the world. The debate is he better than Michael Jordan was?
Yeah, that's a horrible debate, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a silly debate, and a lot of times they're saying, well, it's the number of rings. Look at how many Michael has.
Don't get me started.
It's like, come on, you know, rings are, you're right, it's a team effort. It's not one guy.
Yeah, wow. All right, interesting stuff. Well, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to hear you talk to Scott Stossel, and then let's talk a little bit about the enigma of soccer from the American perspective when the rest of the world is all wackadoo about the World Cup. That's next, and next. When A Touch of Grey continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here, as promised, is our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, in conversation with Scott Stossel. He's the editor of Atlantic Magazine, and he's going to talk to Richard about his memoir titled My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, published by Random House Knopf.
You're not just talking about the anxious feeling that most of us have when we're going to the dentist or something. We're talking about something a lot more serious than just that, correct?
Right. I'm talking about all kinds of anxiety in the book. But, yeah, what you're referring to is and what I talk about in the book at greatest length and what I suffer from myself is clinical anxiety or anxiety disorders. And that's where anxiety, whether it's in the form of phobias like fear of heights or enclosed spaces or flying or public speaking, or social phobia, which is general kind of fear of social interaction, or panic disorder, which is, you know, experiencing these overwhelming panic attacks, you know, becomes so severe that it starts to interfere with your life and really make you miserable. And the latest data, you know, from official sources suggests that, you know, some 1 in 6 American adults suffer from this, and probably similar numbers around the world.
So, Scott, are there people who are just actually anxious at everything, or like you delineated a whole bunch of different things that you can be anxious about? Are there people who are just anxious about one or two things, or are there people who are anxious for a whole host of items?
There's both. I mean, if you have what's known as generalized anxiety disorder, you just have a propensity to sort of worry and think about sort of negative consequences for every potential thing you get involved in, and there is a kind of baseline level of, you know, anxious temperament that some people have that just make them inclined to be worried. Many of these people also have specific separate fears and phobias, but there are also people who, you know, are not generally anxious but have one very specific phobia, whether that's flying or fear of heights. I was actually just last night, someone had written out to me who had read the book, and he's a meteorologist in South Carolina, and he was saying, I talk in my book about sort of fears of public speaking, and he says, I have no fear of public speaking. I go on television every night. I talk to people in public events. He says, but if I'm driving alone at night or trying to get on an airplane, I'm an absolute nervous wreck. So there are definitely weird idiosyncratic fears. One of the most interesting ones I came across, the actor Richard Burton had an intense phobia of honey and literally couldn't be in a room with a jar of honey, even if the jar was closed and even if the jar was locked in a drawer.
I thought you were going to say he had a fear of staying sober, which is another
that issue. That may have been related.
Another issue entirely. Where did these things come from? Are these things traumatic events early in life? I mean, how can we pinpoint some of the causes of these anxieties?
Well, that's I sort of explore all the manifold theories about what causes anxiety, and I think it's a combination of a bunch of different things. I mean, most fundamentally, I think everyone comes with a sort of genetic predisposition to either be, you know, anxious in stressful circumstances or to be not anxious in stressful circumstances. So, you know, you come, you know, almost out of the womb with a certain temperamental predisposition that, you know, gives you a physiology that either reacts with high levels of, you know, stress, or not to. But then on top of that, obviously there, you know, as Freud and many since then have talked about, you know, early childhood experiences and your relationship with your parents and your upbringing can have a powerful effect that can kind of either override or intensify the effects of your genetic heritage. And then, you know, whether you've been exposed to trauma and your level of stress and just kind of what's going on in your life, and then, you know, random luck. I mean, almost everyone has some breaking point. You know, they've done studies of people in the military. You know, some people are supremely resilient to developing PTSD or other forms of anxiety, even under extreme pressure. But most people have some breaking point. It's just that where you fall on that spectrum varies a lot. And some people break down, you know, even before they get to the front. Other people can withstand, you know, multiple horrific things before they crack.
And you describe in great detail your wedding, where your bride is glowing, and you're just going crazy here. You're just so anxious. Did you locate the source of that anxiety? I mean, was it fear of the life going forward in a marital situation, or what was going on there with you?
I mean,
you?
It could have been that underlying it, but really it was just, what I think it mostly was, again, my sort of fear of public you know, speaking, and in fact, I wasn't doing a lot of speaking, but just being in front of all of these people, you know, 250 or so of my closest friends and family and colleagues and my wife's friends. And it was legitimately very hot in the church that day, so I started to sweat. And then, you know, if you're prone to anxiety, you start worrying, well, are people noticing that I'm sweating, which makes you more anxious, which makes you sweat more. And then I could see people looking at me from behind the minister, who are, you know, the people we'd sort of assigned to do the readings, and they could see me turning pale and sweaty, and my best man is handing me handkerchiefs to mop my brow, and I'm starting to shake. And suddenly, you know, I'm trying to go through the wedding, and I'm, like, barely functioning. I'm just, you know, I just have this sort of undercurrent of anxious thoughts running through my mind, which is very typical of, you know, people who suffer from this kind of anxiety. And then, you know, I've talked to people who have read the book who are at the wedding, say, you know, we were at your wedding, and yeah, you looked really sweaty, but we just assumed it was hot and you were a little bit nervous. Like, you know, nobody knew you had this, like, horrific, you know, this internal dialogue where it felt like I was about to die.
You know, people will be listening and they'll go, okay, well, I can take something, can't I, to relieve my anxiety? And that doesn't really solve the problem. It may mask the symptom, but it may cause other problems, no?
Yeah, I mean, I have sort of, you know, there are people in disparate camps on medication. And on one side, you have the people who have the view that, just as you say, that, you know, at best, medication can mask the symptoms for some people without at all addressing the underlying problem, in fact keeping you from addressing the underlying problem. And at worst, maybe the drugs are, you know, causing dependency or creating horrible side effects or simply not helping at all. And on the other side, you know, you have another camp, the kind of Dr. Feelgoods, who will, you know, throw pills at anything and keep throwing more pills at you until you're cured. My own view is that, you know, the critics are right about some things, and we're right to be, you know, both as individuals and as a society, to sort of question our heavy reliance on medication. But as someone who has taken medication more or less continuously and a whole bunch of different ones over like 34 years, I can say, you know, it's true that some of them work only some of the time for some people and they do have dreadful side effects, but they can be enormously effective at, you know, mitigating the worst of the symptoms, and that, you know, they should be an important part of the psychotherapeutic arsenal, and, you know, the mental health field should not be afraid of using them, you know, carefully. But, you know, people also should be prudent about becoming dependent on them. And the jury is still out in the long run about whether, you know, as a society, it's good that we're all so heavily medicated for anxiety and depression. But they can help some people some of the time. So I'm not anti-medication at all.
Well, the book deals with many things in deep detail, and obviously in a radio interview, we don't have time to get into all of them. But give us, for example, meeting new people. A lot of people have anxiety over that, maybe not to the extent that they flop sweat and you know, some of the symptoms you exhibited at your wedding. But how do we overcome some of those anxieties about meeting new people, which is something that happens to all of us every day?
Yeah, well, actually, there are some people who do experience it as acutely as I did during my wedding, where they can't date, they can't work in a workplace. I've come across stories in the clinical literature of, there was a woman who was going to be honored at a dinner, and she couldn't bear the thought of all that attention on her, so she pled ill. And then they rescheduled the dinner for just a smaller group, and even that smaller gathering was so terrifying to her that she quit her job rather than do that. This was for a positive thing. So there are some people whose lives are completely constrained by this. So, you know, one of the most effective treatments for all forms of anxiety these days, and also for things like depression and insomnia, is something called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which is basically kind of a concentrated form of talk therapy that's focused, you know, with anxiety, specifically on exposing yourself to the thing that you fear the most and learning to, you know, you experience the anxiety and then learn that you can cope with it, and then working with a therapist to retrain your thought pattern so you don't have such negative kind of running dialogue in your head. Like, people with those acute social phobia, and they're meeting people, they're saying, oh, they don't like me, or they think I'm ugly, or I just said something stupid, and they kind of get in their own way. And so you, this is sort of retraining your thought patterns to not have those thoughts, and just practice. I mean, as with all specific phobias, exposure to the thing that you are afraid of and doing it again and again is the best way to reduce the anxiety. Now, it's easier said than done. As I say, as somebody with acute phobias myself, there's nothing more terrifying than being exposed to the thing you're terrified of, but that is often the prescribed remedy.
Scott Stossel, in conversation with Richard Neer. His book is titled My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, published by Random House Knopf. I'm Michael Harrison in the Anchor Chair. Richard Neer returns for some final conversation in the next segment coming up as we conclude our two-hour broadcast of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the Anchor Chair, and we continue our conversation for this final segment of our two-hour get-together with our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. So, Richard, soccer, World Cup, big deal. I have a sister who lives in Brazil. She has, plenty to say about it. It's like in the air. You know, it's like, okay, I understand. You know, that's all they're thinking about in Brazil. They may as well shut down the country. That's how big a deal. That's how big a deal this is. And yet in this country, every kid plays soccer, every mom is a soccer mom, and yet, outside of it being a sport that kids play and moms take you to, it doesn't seem to catch on. What's the deal?
It is not American.
Then why do kids like to play it so much?
Think about it. tennis was huge in this country when we had McEnroe and Connors and guys like that. We don't have any American stars anymore, and nobody really cares about tennis except for the hardcore guys. Mm. And I think it's that way with soccer. There are hardcore people who are recently into this country, coming from other countries, and they love it, and they their world revolves around it. And yet Americans growing up on baseball and football are into those sports and could not care less about soccer, no matter how much ESPN tries to sell it to us.
Yeah, well, you know, but the kids play it. Kids play soccer. I don't know if kids
because
play
baseball.
Because
it's cheap.
Okay.
Soccer, you don't need a lot of equipment. You don't need a massive field. All you need is a goal set up in a fairly flat area. You have some pads and some shoes, but you don't have bats and hockey sticks and all kinds of pads like you need in football. It's not dangerous in the sense, you know, football, you can concussions and everything else.
I have tried 100 times to watch soccer and understand it and get into it, and I always wind up after 10, 12, 15 minutes, I can turn it off or walk away.
But a lot of soccer fans from other countries watch baseball, and they have the same reaction. They go, this is so boring, nothing's happening.
Well, sometimes I feel that way, but not always. One quick question. Are kids playing baseball today the way they did when we were kids? When I was a kid, being a ball player was the currency of how your status was among the other boys. I mean, you had your mitt. You had to play baseball, or you couldn't be part of any gang or group or social scene as a kid. We're talking 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. Is it that way anymore? Is baseball that much of a deal to kids?
No, and that's the problem with baseball growing as a sport and why football has overtaken it. Mm. And baseball is taking great efforts to get kids into the sport. The problem is, they start the darn World Series games at 9 o'clock at night, and kids are asleep by the time I'm asleep by the time the games are over.
Yeah.
So they don't market it the way football does.
I can't believe they started this past week the Miami game.
9 o'clock?
The Spurs, 9 o'clock at night?
Yeah.
Now, I mean, if you're living in California, great, you watch it over dinner. But the fact is, 9 o'clock at night to start a game on a school night, you know, when that thing is over? I mean, it's like, come on.
That's a big, big problem with the kids getting into sport these days. See, the National Football League games are at 1 o'clock, 4 o'clock. That's it. It's easy. You can watch the games, have dinner, go to sleep.
Yeah, I mean, except for Sunday night, but that's another deal.
Yeah.
Richard, it is always a pleasure speaking to you. So who's your pick for the World Cup? I don't even know who's playing.
Well, our coach here, Jürgen Klinsmann, says the United States team has no chance of winning. The coach.
Wow.
How would you like to play for a coach if Bill Belichick told you, Tom Brady, hey, Tom, got no chances here. Forget about it.
Maybe it's reverse psychology.
Go through the motions, Tom.
That's really
funny.
Can't make it. That's really funny. Well, that, you know, it lowers expectations.
He's probably right, but yeah, I don't think you tell people that, do you?
Oh, my gosh. All right. Thank you very much, Richard Neer. Thank you, Beverly Santinello, on the front line, our producer. Thank you to Steve Wiseman and to Kevin Casey. Thank you, Carol Marks, the host of the program. And thank you for listening. I'm Michael Harrison on behalf of all of us. Join us next weekend right here for another 2-hour installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.